Steve and Kevin discuss the latest banned and restricted list update on episode 114 of So Many Insane Plays. Welcome to episode 114 of So Many Insane Plays, our banned and restricted list update. I'm Kevin Crone with Steven Menendian.
Hi, everyone.
If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can tweet us at Many Insane Plays, email us at somanyinsaneplayspodcast@gmail.com, or leave feedback on Eternal Central, MTGcast, or themanadrain.com. We're going to keep plugging it.
I don't think even though it doesn't exist anymore.
At this point, it's just vestigial and comforting.
It is. We'll keep it. Someday it'll come back.
We'll see. It needs a new benefactor. We do have what would normally be an incredible announcement for this show. Eternal Weekend 2024 has been announced. October 12 through 13 in Shizuoka, Japan, November 21 through 24 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and December 6 through 8 in Prague, Czech Republic. We'll talk all about that announcement and the implications thereof in our next show. But we have been late with many episodes for the last couple of years in this show, but this one we are not late with. We are recording on the day of our latest banned and restricted list announcement. That is Monday, August 26th, and we are here to talk about the latest announcement for Vintage affecting two cards.
I hate to burst your bubble, but the kids these days will say, yeah, you recorded on the day, but it wasn't in the same hour.
So. You're right. We are still products of our age, you and I, and the medium is the message. So at this point, yeah, it is a little bit outdated. I apologize for that, but we're doing our best. All right. So we're not going to beat around the bush here. Today, Urza's Saga and Vexing Bauble were restricted in Vintage, and this was not something that people were greatly expecting. Let's put it that way. And we could talk about why that might be. But we're going to do our normal diligence and talk about how this change fits within the history of the restricted list, talk about some of the things we measure and monitor vis-a-vis the criteria, and then at the end, we'll talk about some of our expectations about the impact. So, Steve, you can take us away with some of the history of the restricted list, which you are so wont to track.
I am delighted to do so. Before we get into too much history, let's just start with what this means, not in terms of the metagame, but in terms of statistics. So this restriction constitutes the 102nd and 103rd card to ever be added to the Type 1/Vintage restricted list in the history of the format. And since there have been, over that period, 52 cards restricted, which, by the way, is just about perfectly 50%, right, Kevin? Unrestricted.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So you have 103 cards restricted in the 26-year period. Hold on. Let me do the math. We're at 30 years of the format.
That's right.
30 years of the format. There have been 103 cards added, 52 cards removed. That leaves us with a current restricted list size, Kevin, drum roll, of 51.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just if you're into min-maxes, the minimum number of restricted cards ever on the list was 16. Fun trivia question. See if you can figure out at what point in time there were only 16 cards. The reason it's a fun trivia question is because it's not the obvious answer. So,
I certainly didn't know, and it is a vanishingly small amount of time.
Also, fun fact. The most cards ever on the Vintage restricted list is 54. So right now we're at a, I don't know, comfortable 51, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
54 is the max. And fun trivia question, at what point in time was the set at 54? Let me just think about this as a trivia question. I will give you the answer. I'm not going to give you the answer to the other one because we want you to give us feedback on this. But if I were to ask you, do you think that if there's 30 years in the format and we divide it up into 15-year segments, so 15, the first 15 and the second 15, Did the 54 maximum size vintage restricted lists occur in the first 15 years of the format or the more recent 15 years of the format?
A compelling question.
And since I'm asking that question, people will probably guess, would probably originally would think that it happened in the more recent 15 years, but since I'm asking it, obviously happened in the original 15 years. But did you know it was 20 years ago?
No, I never would have guessed.
Yes, the vintage restricted list was 54 cards as of January 1st, 2004, which was, of course, when they restricted Lion's Eye Diamond, Chrome Mox, and Burning Wish. So only one of those three cards is still restricted. It has hit 51 cards. It had 53 cards in 2008, but it went down to 41 cards in 2013, and it stayed at 41 cards until late in 2015. So 41, it's been mostly in the 40s. In fact, it was in the 40s in the entire duration, Kevin, of the 2010s, except for the last month of that decade. Yep. So in the 2010s, you had a smaller restricted list than you had at any point in this century, basically. Right? Because it... Yep. So
well, and part of the reason for that humorous fact is that the largest single change in the Banner restricted list after its inception happened right at the end of 1999.
Yes, which was equal to the initial size of the restricted list.
Right, so we rang in the new millennium with a new modern restricted list size where it ballooned up to 45.
This is so funny. I don't know why this is so funny to me, but it's just, I mean, so what this means is that this is the first time this decade that the vintage restricted list is above 50 cards. Because it sat at 50 for 5 years, and then we got to 49 in March when Ponder was unrestricted, but now we're back above 50 at 51. So, Kevin, anything else you want to say just statistically in terms of the descriptive statistics of the vintage restricted list?
Just that the median change over this full 30-year history to the list, the median change is 2 cards.
Yes. Yes, so... Go ahead.
There are several ones. There are several one-card changes. Don't get me wrong. But the median change still is 2. So this change that we're experiencing today is very much in line with a common occurrence.
Yeah, one of the things that we've talked about a lot is the need to make restrictions in single cases, because a single restriction by its natural effect transforms the metagame system. Mm-hmm. Because you're affecting a pillar of the format in every case. And so we have urged caution. One of the observations I've made on this podcast many times is that every time they have restricted more than one card, except with, I think, one exception ever, it has always resulted in more unrestrictions. I think the one exception is Necropotence and Demonic Consultation. Until I think at least 2019. Every time you have a restriction that's more than one card, it's because you're hitting often multiple cards that do the same thing. So like the restriction of Lion's Eye Diamond, Burning Wish, and Chrome Mox is a good example. It's designed to hammer the same deck. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you do something that hammers the same deck, there's a good chance you're overreaching. So, I mean, we've seen this with the restrictions of, the Gush restriction, the original one, has now had Ponder unrestricted from that. So that's no longer the exception. Yes, Merchant Skull, Brainstorm, Gush, and Flash are all restricted, but now Ponder has been removed. So It proves my point about overreach. I think that it's true that it's been about 2, but for the most part, I think they've done a diligent job of doing a lot of ones and twos. Where I get nervous is when it's like 4, 5 or more. And just to be clear, keep it in this century.
Since 99. There's definitely a different era pre-99.
Yeah, since 99. Well, I was going to stick technically to the century, so let's do since 2001, which is technically the century. The restrictions have been in cases of 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 5, 1, 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 2, 4, 1, 2. That's today. So most of those cases are actually single restrictions. Most of them, I believe, of the what I just said. The yes. one egregious, the one case that's more than five, the only case that was five was the restriction we just mentioned, the wave restriction of the Flash, Gush, Merchant Scroll, Ponder, and Brainstorm.
Right.
The only other case of four was in response to Modern Horizons, which, if I recall correctly, included Golgari Grave Troll, Mystic Forge, and then two other cards I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm sure we can get... actually, I'll tell you what those were. Hold on. It was Karn, the Great Creator, and Mental Misstep. But they unrestricted Fastbond at the same time. So even though they restricted four cards, the net increase was only three. So those are really the only big... Everything else is... Really, Kevin, besides those two restrictions and the Burning Wish restriction, everything else this century has been two or one.
Yep. Yeah, the 20th century changes to the list are definitely more... definitely more impactful and larger quantities. The two biggest changes are extreme outliers, the creation of the list and then the 1999 change. Those are extreme outliers. Beyond those two 18 card additions, the next largest change was seven cards in August of 94.
And what's interesting is if you look at both of those hits of 18, they were massive overreactions.
So definitely.
Like most of the cards that were hit because the October 99 restrictions were after they were really a sign of frustration and exasperation, because in January they restricted three cards to try and deal with Academy, and then in April they did three more to deal with it after Destiny, the second set in Urza's block came out, and then after the third set they were just basically like, "F it, we're just gonna nuke everything," and like over half, like I think over 2/3 of those cards have been unrestricted. So the following cards that were restricted in October of 99 have now been unrestricted. Crop Rotation, Doomsday, Dream Halls, Enlightened Tutor, Frantic Search, Grim Monolith, Urkel's Recall, Mind Over Matter, Mox Diamond, Voltaic Key, and Yawgmoth's Bargain. So the only cards that are still restricted from that restriction are Yawgmoth's Will, which is totally justifiable, Vamp Tutor, Tinker, Mystical Tutor, Lotus Petal, Mana Crypt, and Mana Vault. So that's less than half the cards.
Yeah.
So that shows you how much overreach there was. But they were sick of trying to deal with it, so they're like, let's just, you know, the famous line from Aliens.
I know the one.
Let's just nuke it from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. So, and indeed they did. Indeed they did. But yeah. That's what happens when you take a nuke, right? Like, you're going to have some splash spillover effects, as economists like to call it.
It's a
little bit, forgive me if that's a little insensitive, but yes, there's spillover effects when you nuke something. So, Kevin, this is an interesting case because both of these cards go into different decks here. So we're going to break down what this means and what this looks like in terms of other things. It does resemble more the case of sort of like, I think the Monastery Mentor in Thorn hit, where you hit two different archetypes simultaneously, or the Karn Forge. I mean, I guess Karn and Forge were in the same deck, but really you're hitting multiple tentpoles simultaneously with Troll.
I would amend what you said just a little bit from a philosophical standpoint, because it's clear that Urza Saga and Vexing Bauble do go in the same decks frequently, but I think the philosophy of what you're saying is this change was not targeting a specific deck in practice.
Yes.
They cited some specific decks in the language, which we'll get to, but the change is far more sweeping than that. And that's one of the things, that's one of the characteristics that we're going to tease out about this change in particular, which sets it aside, I think, and makes it somewhat unique throughout the history of the format.
Fair enough. So yeah. Before we get to the text, let's just go through the criteria for restriction. Kevin, do you want to just explain what you think the criteria should be, and then I'll present mine?
Well, there's a lot of terminology that gets used when we have these discussions, inevitably, year over year, across all Magic formats, right? And some of the things that they're frequently cited are format diversity. That's a big one. That is, I mean, one of the things we immediately go to is what portion of the metagame or top eights or even victories does this... the deck that these cards are from represent. That's the phenomenon I was just referring to. This is not quite the same kind of thing where a single deck is dominating. And that raises questions about whether or not it's possible to fight said deck, which is a variant of format diversity, but it speaks to kind of the power of the card or cards in the deck in question. So some cards have been cited as, even if it wasn't a significant portion of a metagame, we still don't want this effect in the format. And then the other thing I think of lately, and this is probably not on your list because it's far less structured, and that is format or community sentiment, basically. There are some cards which are just so derided and people do not enjoy playing against them that even if the other metrics don't pass a certain threshold by themselves, the community's input can carry more weight. And I think we're entering an era, we have entered an era where community sentiment is a significant factor in the DCI's decisions. So that my list is not as comprehensive as yours, but that's what I think of when we evoke the conversation.
Yes. I think those are very reasonable sort of ways of thinking about the restricted list. And I use the word reasonable here in a very considered way, because I am a veteran of decades of fights over the restricted list. So
yes, so you absolutely are.
So it's important to take, you know, so something can be reasonable and you can still disagree about it, right? There's reasonable policy debates all the time where people don't agree on policy, but they can at least say that's a reasonable position to take, right? It's not irrational. In fact, that is a level review that courts will often give to reviewing legislation. They'll ask, is there a reasonable basis? They call it rational review test. So I have written, obviously, 20 years of Magic articles, if not more, on the banned and restricted list, and there are many different articles you could point to that have my presented philosophy. I think that, you know, in the past, so I will point to two articles I've written, one in 2018 and one in 2019, among the more recent, that tried to sort of summarize my and articulate my position. In the 2018 article for Eternal Central, Kevin, I essentially articulated three criteria. And, you know, back in the day, the main reason to restrict is dominance. And dominance is essentially analogous in the antitrust context to monopoly power, which, by the way, there is literally a century of judicial precedent trying to figure out how to define what a monopoly is, what dominance is. And depending on the court case, you might say there's a famous case called Alcoa, which was where the Supreme Court was trying to apply a Sherman Act claim, Sherman Antitrust Act claim. And essentially, they said, you know, 90% market share is dominance. It's monopoly. But it can be substantially below that. It could be potentially 60% market share, or even like in the 40s. And similar debates have happened in vintage. So the clearest case for restriction is where you have a dominant deck that cannot be defeated. That is Serlin's famous rules, right? That the only way to ban something in playing to win, his famous thing, is when it just cannot be defeated by any other tactics. And very rarely is there actually a dominant deck, though, because it's really hard for something to actually just straight up dominate. To create like an 80-90% market share is extremely unrealistic. There's going to be a share of people who just don't want to play the best deck, right? So it's going to be like, even if there is an absolute best deck with the highest win rate and is going to be winning the only deck you can play to win a tournament, in a format like Vintage, like 50% of the tournament player base is just not going to play it, even in a high-stakes tournament. They're just going to play what they like, you know, over that, or to be contrarian or whatever. So it's really hard, you know, for a deck that's to get even over like 60% of top eights or of tournament victories, even if it's just clearly the best deck. So I had always sort of had this second criteria, which is oligopoly, which is another antitrust concept that basically means, okay, it's not a dominant deck, but it's one of a couple of dominant decks. And together they stranglehold the format. So there's monopoly dominance, and then there's sort of oligopoly. And there's various terms that you could use to describe that. In the past, I've said that a card can be distorting, or a deck can be distorting to the metagame or the market, even if it doesn't outright dominate it. And then a third criteria in my 2018 article was interactivity. Because even if something isn't dominant, it can be just really unfun to play against if it's your turn one Trinisphered out, or turn one Flashed out, or turn one Chaliced out. I think there is something to interactivity. But it's amazing. 1 year later, Kevin, I rewrote my sort of suggested, banned, and restricted list, and I had much, much more precise. This is in my 2020 article. Much, much more precise terms here. So the first criteria, at five criteria, and I used the term dominance, but I didn't use it in terms of metagame share or market share to continue the antitrust analogy. Instead, dominance is sustained win rate. And that is, if you have a deck that has a very high win rate, and once you actually have enough data or the form of data where you can calculate win rates, then sustained win rate becomes a very interesting and influential quantitative factor. The second thing I used is metagame diversity. So it's not just whether there is a deck that has a sustained extremely high win rate, but can you actually quantify the number of competitive decks? And I have done that. I have a formula called the Gini-Simpson coefficient, which is a formula you can run metagames into, and it measures both relative win rates and representation of competitive decks. I think the Gini coefficient, it's similar to Gini coefficient, but it's the Simpson Gini coefficient. It actually tells you a lot. So that's a second criteria. It's not just dominance, it's metagame diversity, quantity of competitive decks. Third, I said competitive balance. So it's not just sustained win rate, but what is match win rate across the top tiers of decks? So you can have no decks that dominate, but you might have competitive imbalance. So that is those three criteria are all objective, statistically quantifiable data points. And if I was running the DCI, or whatever the contemporary term for whoever manages this is, I would use these quantitative criteria and then supplement them with qualitative criteria. And the two qualitative criteria I used, Kevin, was counterplay. And counterplay is actually a much more nuanced and I think precise term for what I meant by interactivity. Because interactivity is really, really, I remember having huge forum wars with Peter Olszewski and others like in the 2000s about what is interactivity? How do you even know what interactivity is? And we sort of came to a philosophy that interactivity is if I do something, you have a meaningful chance to respond or do something about it, or at least an opportunity to, and that I have an opportunity to respond to that thing or do something about it proactively. But it's so imprecise. And I don't know what genius came up with this term counterplay, but counterplay really captures what people care about with interactivity. It's does your opponent's actions afford you any opportunity to do anything? In strategies or tactics that really eliminate counterplay, eliminate a key facet of what makes Magic fun, which is meaningful choice. So counterplay is actually, I think, a really good way of capturing this qualitative dynamic. And I think counterplay is actually the key thing for vexing Bobble, which we'll come to in a minute. And then the fifth criteria is just polarization. So even if you have a format where there is no dominant deck, where you have a diversity of competitive decks, where you have metagame balance, and you have counterplay, it's still possible to have polarization. And polarization is something that has been talked about a lot in economics and political science lately. Ezra Klein wrote a big book called Why We're Polarized, and people have a much sharper conception of what it is. But basically, in a metagame term, it means that the metagame is spread between two poles. And the best way to conceptualize polarization is probably the workshop gush metagame, where you either played the workshop deck or you either played. It's basically an oligopoly, and it's more than an oligopoly. It's everything is oriented around those poles, right? And so there's nothing in the middle. Polarization, in its technical sense, means that things are moving towards an extreme. So if you have a polarized economy, it means that wages are either at the high end or the low end, and there's a hollowing out of the middle class. In a metagame context, it's more of what I just said, that people are being compelled to play one of the two poles. And you don't really want to be in a polarized metagame. You want a multipole metagame, a modular, multipolarity in a metagame. So I think my 2020 statement here actually has the best, or 2019 statement, I should say, has the best articulation of criteria I've ever come up with. So just to rename them, and I'll put them in the order I originally presented them in. Number one, metagame diversity. What is the quantity of competitive decks? Number two, competitive balance. What is the match win percentage? Number three, dominance. Is there a deck that has an unjustly sustained win rate, measured either in terms of just overall win rate top eight penetration rate, or tournament victories, but over mainly the first. Fourth, counterplay, and number five, polarization. I think that that delineation of five criteria is much better than the three I had presented in 2018, which was just dominance, monopoly power, number one. Number two, imbalance, meaning oligopoly power, and number three, interactivity. Counterplay is much more nuanced, and polarization creates really unfun metagames, even if you have technically competitive balance. So this is, I think, I'm not in the Bowser, and no longer do I really correspond with a lot of people who work at Wizards, so I don't know how they think about these things. But I think this is, I don't know how the official policymakers here think about this, but this is sort of my, I don't know, it's not the received wisdom, it's my imparted wisdom of how things should be managed for Vintage. And I realize that there is community input, but in my opinion, community input should be used through one of these criteria. Right. If community input accords with one of these criteria, then it should be applied. But if it doesn't, if it's just people complaining or kvetching without actually framing it in terms of one of these criteria, then I'm not really thrilled about that.
Well, on that last point too, I mean, I completely agree with you in principle. If a person is just saying, "Hey, this sucks and I don't like it," that is not a policy position, naturally. But we also must bear in mind that WotC is a for-profit company, and if for no particular reason their customers are just unhappy, that is still a meritable metric on their part, even if it can't be or isn't well articulated. We don't really need to argue that point any further, I don't think. Thank you for that summary there, and it's one of the reasons why I like having banner restricted list shows with you, is because it affords you the opportunity to lay all that out. And I would posit that your positions are well researched and well conceived and stress tested over time too, right? Like this is not something you have just offered up in a vacuum. This is a thing that you have applied and honed and evolved over years. That didn't just spring forth in this moment.
Correct. Yes.
And I want to give us an opportunity to transition from your criteria to how those concepts are represented in the latest announcement, where we have, thankfully, four or five paragraphs of explanation.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to talk about in terms of pivoting to how those criteria are represented today?
Well, it's hard to say because I'm not actually in the discussion meetings. At the DCI, but I think if we go through, the one thing I would say is that the actual banned and restricted list page has a kind of explication that correlates to this, to these criteria. So I'll just read what the current banned and restricted list official page says at the top, and then we'll read the reasoning here. It says, quote, "One of the keys to the continued health of Magic is diversity. It is vitally important to ensure that there are multiple competitive decks for the tournament player to choose from. Why? If there were only a single viable deck to play, tournaments would quickly stagnate as players were forced to either play that deck or build or a deck built specifically to beat it. In addition, different players enjoy playing different types of decks. If there are plenty of viable options to play, there will be more players at tournaments. To help maintain the diversity and health of the Magic tournament environment, a system of banned and restricted lists has been developed." That's the substantive reasoning. You can see in that statement the criteria I just mentioned, right? Especially the first three. If you have a dominant deck that has an absurd sustained win rate, you necessarily have less metagame diversity. You can actually directly measure metagame diversity, and then and competitive balance, which are sort of, they're not, it's not just, metagame diversity and metagame balance are not the same thing as dominance. Because you can have a format that has no dominant deck and is still not diverse and or not competitively balanced, right? And you can have a deck that is, by the way, diverse and doesn't have competitive balance. It is competitive imbalanced. So you need all of these things to supplement each other. There's some overlap, but they also do different work. That's why they have to be independent criteria, right? So they flow from each other. But I think all three of those flow from the statement that was just made there. And I think that's a very good encapsulation. It does not have counterplay or polarization there. And I think there's a legitimate argument as to whether polarization can be subsumed into one of the other criteria, but I think it's worth setting out separately simply because it looks and feels different. And there's something to be said for the ability to perceive and identify a dynamic, even if it is technically subsumed within another dynamic. You know, mm-hmm. it's like sometimes things are masked or obscured within a larger phenomena, and you have to name it in order to observe it as a separate or as a specific subset of that larger phenomena. And so, go ahead.
And I think this announcement is really going to test our interpretation and application of these things, specifically in the area of diversity, because this these restrictions are, I would posit, unlike any prior application of the restricted list to affect diversity. What I'm observing about this particular change, and we'll get into the minutia here in a minute, but is just that we have talked about metagame diversity many times in the past, and it's the root of many of the changes. But I really think there's actually multiple different types of diversity that are implied, and metagame is just the dominant one, where there are other interpretations, and the one that we're observing here is more along the lines of deck construction or gameplay diversity, such that the same gameplay is being demonstrated by wholly different decks in the format in a way that there's a matter of homogeneity and of gameplay that is just
that's
not
tactical.
Possible.
Yeah,
tactical gameplay that has not been possible, or at least has never manifest across vintage or maybe even any other format. Wow. The level of homogeneity
because
in
of
decks,
Urza's Saga and so forth. Yeah. Well, let's get to the explanation. Let's comment on each sentence, and then let's apply some of these points. I don't mean to. Is there anything else you wanted to say though about that?
No, that was it, that is the next step.
Okay, so we'll take turns reading.
sure.
So vintage. I'll start with the first paragraph, Kevin. Since the removal of Lurrus of the Dream Den from the very selective vintage ban list in 2021, the companion has been a growing part of the vintage metagame. I think it's interesting to say the companion. They're sort of admitting here that the other companions have sort of disappeared with the errata to the companion mechanic, so it's just the companion.
Right.
It's become the companion. This cat has become the vintage companion, in essence. It's
That's
become
right.
our familiar. So it also says a growing part of the vintage metagame. I wonder if that's true. Is there actually statistical evidence that there has been a continuous or linear increase in play since 2021, or has it oscillated and been secular? Do you know if it actually has grown?
Well, alluding back to our year in review show, it has been cyclical. I mean,
yeah, that's my impression.
But there may have been a multi-year trend that we
upwards.
Didn't really study as part of our yearly shows. So it's possible that that is true and that they have actually demonstrated that.
I
can't confirm.
You know, in the last 10 years, I've read so many more. I wish that I had come into my vintage writing with the sort of analytical and academic rigor that I now have, because that sort of sentence, if it was in an NBER paper or if it was in a Federal Reserve study, would absolutely have to be quantifiably fact-checked and provable. Like, you know, like,
naturally.
Yeah, a policymaker, like the Federal Reserve, when an economist at the Federal Reserve could not make that statement unless it was quantifiably true. You know, but the DCI says things like that just in passing. It's like, yeah, it's been a growing share of the metagame. Has it actually, like, I don't know if that's actually true. But go ahead.
Yeah, the community tools that we have for this kind of thing could almost certainly chart that over time, but I didn't do that amount of work this afternoon, so... Let's just say that it is presumptively true, but I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay. So they said since the removal of this card from the very selective vintage ban list, and by the way, just going back, I want to just remind people how, is it really selective? I mean, okay, so here's what's on the here's what's really on the ban list. You have two dexterity cards, Chaos Orb and Falling Star. You have Scheherazade. Then there are 9 cards that are anti. Then there is the 25 conspiracies. Then there is a list of cards that are racially or culturally offensive. And this, I mean, how many are on here still? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And then there is all cards that bring a sticker or attraction into the game, which is, let's see. I can't even make a list of this. The point is, the point is, the ban list is actually much larger than the restricted list. Much larger, right? I mean, it is. Go ahead.
That is technically true, but that's not really usefully true, right? Like, when you're categorically removing anti, it doesn't matter how many anti cards Richard Garfield created in 1992 and 3. Like, you're just removing that category. So I would say that categorically, this statement is true, even if quantifiably the banned card list is much larger than the restricted list.
But that's how people... But there's a reason we spent all this time quantifying the restricted list, right? We didn't talk about the categories in the restricted list. We didn't talk about here's creatures and here's drawing cards, here's enchantments.
No, I think you must admit, though, that the restricted list doesn't have these subsets of design policy failures, right? Like stickers.
Yes.
Stickers are...
I'm not disagreeing with your point. I just think that this was unnecessary rhetoric. Because because
that much I could agree with.
Because,
it is unnecessary.
Because it's not clear what that even means.
And in a document like this that is ostensibly about transparency of policy and decision making, that kind of rhetorical flourish is unhelpful and distracting. Which is, I think, part of what you're getting at.
Yes. I don't. You could just say, since the removal from the vintage ban list in 2021, and by the way, there should be a link to that announcement, the companion has been a growing part of the vintage metagame. Second sentence. As a result, as a format, vintage tends to evolve slower than others, generally taking quite some time to show obvious signs of needing maintenance. So there's two different concepts that are conflated in this sentence. And I hate to be a nitpicker and a stickler here, but I just don't think this is particularly well written. I don't know that it's actually true that vintage does evolve slower. I think if you were to actually compare the experimentation that happens in vintage in like the immediate days after the release, it tends to be quite rapid. Like the Modern Horizon sets, like the very next vintage challenge has them being cards played in spades. Like I'm not actually sure it's true. It is true that it evolves differently than other formats because it has a larger card pool. Individual cards may have less impact, but that doesn't mean they have less uptake. Impact and uptake should not be confused, right? And you have a small set like in Modern, and you have a set like Modern Horizons, the impact is going to be larger because the card pool is smaller. But that doesn't mean that the format is evolving faster. It may look like it, but I don't think that's actually quantitatively true. So I object to that statement. It is true that in the past, vintage has evolved faster. Like in 2000, vintage just evolved slower. I don't think that's true since Magic Online or the vintage challenges. I just don't. Now, someone can take issue with me on that. In some ways, you could actually say that the professional formats evolve slower because the pros are actually holding their technology innovations in abeyance until a big tournament. Whereas, like, in vintage, there's nothing that... If you are a vintage experimentalist and you're a technology pusher, you are trying out your new tech immediately, right? Yes, there's occasions where people leading up to Vintage Championship will hold off their tech, but they're still usually probably playing it in data that's accessible to the DCI, right? It's, like, going to be in dailies and things like that, so...
You know what I think could be going on here is that we know that the vintage community, that is the pure quantity of players and tournaments, is smaller than most other formats.
Yes.
Especially the top few formats.
Yes.
And that translates directly into fewer results in the data behind the scenes.
Yes.
We see that in our end user facing tools like MTG Goldfish, and Wizards undoubtedly has more than we have, and they would see it too. I wonder if there's an observation bias going on here where the effect that you're talking about, like week over week change between, the vintage challenges, metagame responses are non-obvious to the observer because they're less invested and they don't note where, say, a one or two card change in a sideboard is a direct response to the prior week's results.
Yes.
And because they're not seeing hundreds of players making those kind of tweaks and saying, oh, this is a metagame shift because 100 people added this one card to their sideboard. Instead, it's represented by 2, 3, 4 players in a 60-person tournament, you know. But maybe just the dramatically smaller sample size leads them to infer that the changes are more random
but less
sculpted.
Anyone who has studied evolutionary biology knows that actually small populations have faster evolution.
Well, no, I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. My point is the observation bias that I think might be going on here, that the big numbers are just drawing all the attention on the WOTC side.
Let me just make that point. So if in evolutionary biology, smaller populations are able to evolve more quickly because a mutation in the genetic gene pool, in the gene pool, can spread more quickly. So for example,
it represents a larger portion of the population,
exactly.
That
so
mutation.
There's an example of this that I read about, I don't remember where I read this, years ago, about pygmy mastodons or mammoths that got separated out in like northern Siberia during the last ice age. And they actually evolved much more quickly because there was a smaller gene pool. That's actually what happened in the Galapagos that allowed Darwin to observe Darwinian evolution. Mm-hmm. That the smaller populations of... So I think this is both gratuitous and wrong to say this. Like, I think it's true. It is true that there are fewer players playing it. It is true that there is... It takes a longer time to get large data sets. But that should not be mistaken for this presumption or that vintage evolves more slowly. I think if anything, the Modern Horizons assimilation into the vintage format has been, I would contend, if you go back to Modern Horizons 1, the assimilation of Modern Horizons into vintage was as fast as Modern Horizons was assimilated into any other format. As someone who was playing like every vintage challenge at that time, I was testing every card. When Modern Horizons 2 came out, I was Grief in Modern Horizons 2. I was playing Grief literally immediately. Immediately.
There were 2 Nadu decks in the NYSE Open Top 8.
Yes! No, this is just not true, and it's actually insulting to vintage players to say that vintage evolves more slowly. Does it need... Now, the second clause says, generally taking some time to show obvious signs of needing maintenance. I would agree that that is true. But it's not because the format evolves more slowly. It's because it takes more time to come to definitive conclusions about things. It takes more time. Now, it may appear to be a paradoxical tension between the two points I've made, but it's not. It's just like it takes more time for the signals in the metagame to reach people to consolidate around the best deck because people are so experimentally oriented in the format. It takes a lot of persuasion before people finally absorb those signals and then finally consolidate around a set of decks. So I think again, there's like gratuitous language here that's incorrect. Okay, moving on to the third sentence. In fact, aside from the recent banning of sticker and attraction cards, by the way, when did that actually happen?
It was just within the last 2 months. I couldn't tell you the exact date.
Okay, I will look that up. The last few changes made to the format involved unbanning and unrestriction. That is technically true, as we have just noted.
It refers to Ponder, and then it refers to Fast Bond in terms of unrestriction. It's worth noting that there were still more additions to the list in that same time period, but I don't know how to interpret this statement.
Hold on a second.
The last few changes made in the format involved unbanning and unrestricting. That is patently correct. They did involve unrestriction and unbanning.
They said this is a good sign that vintage has been in a good spot for some time now. That's all fair. I think those are all fair. I think that the fact that they have said that mostly it's been unrestriction and unbanning is a good sign, and I think that's fair. I do think though that that assumes that they have been paying attention to the format, and they don't necessarily indicate that they've been studying vintage. So I think they could have just, instead of saying that, what they could have said, Kevin, is that we have been studying the vintage format over the time and generally have found it to be healthy and therefore not needing of restriction. This is indicated by the fact that we have decided to unrestrict and unban cards instead of making further restrictions. Public signs that vintage has been a good spot for some time now. Do you see the difference between those two things? So,
well, absolutely. And I think to put more specificity to it, prior to the Ponder unrestriction, which was welcome, there hadn't been a change for 5 years, basically. 4.5 years. And, I mean, if you just don't make any changes for a time period, then that points to a couple of things, which we've talked about, and namely in the Ponder change, but in multiple changes prior. One or both of two things are happening. The format is healthy, which you just alluded to, or you're just not being proactive about maintaining it, which I think is also true. So pointing to a dearth of change can make either or both of those cases. And I think in this case, it makes both of those cases. Vintage has been in a good spot. And if Ponder hadn't been unrestricted, we'd still be perfectly fine, right? That if that change hadn't been made, the format would still be tooling along. We'd be okay. But yeah, the lack of unrestrictions over that period points to a real unattentive management of the list, in my opinion. But I've said that before.
I just want to ask you one quick question. I appreciate that. Were the sticker and attraction cards ever legal in Vintage?
Oh, yes, definitely. And the change was made in May, mid-May, so it was a little more than 2 months ago by now's standards.
Okay. I need to...
Yeah.
So they were very briefly legal.
No. They were legal for quite a while. Oh. They were just... There's only like one sticker card that's even remotely playable in Eternal, and it's the name sticker Goblin, which is only really useful in Legacy Goblins.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Why were they banned, by the way? What's the...
They introduce tournament logistic problems because, and this is again really obscure, when you play with sticker cards, you don't have uniform access to the same stickers every game. You bring a pre-chosen set
yes.
of potential stickers, and then you randomly choose at the start of the game what you have access to. So if you're playing with name sticker Goblin, which rewards you for having high I forget if it's letter or word counts, it doesn't matter, high verbiage counts in the stickers you choose, you just bring the 10 sticker selection lists that have the most of those in it, and you randomly pick from those. The problem comes if you are, let's say, a Vintage player. There's a very real Vintage application of this. Let's say you're playing Jewel Shops and you're playing against a Goblin's opponent and they have a name sticker Goblin in play. Look at what happens when you draw Phyrexian Metamorph.
What do you do? Yeah.
Now you could be playing a sticker deck.
Yes.
Except you didn't bring your own stickers to the table because you weren't expecting to, right? So then you've got a tournament integrity problem where you've got a player who is instructed to place a sticker on a card and yet they didn't come prepared with any stickers. Now, this is not a big problem. In fact, it's probably exceedingly vanishingly rare. But it's just one of those things kind of like Scheherazade, where it rather than mess with this from a policy standpoint, they just said, you know what, these cards are not intended to be played in tournaments. They were meant to be jokes. Let's just excise them from the game way.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's in a sense no different than just like banning the unsets, you know, in a sense.
In a sense, yes, but because Wizards has Wizards had stockholders, the sets which were supposed to be filled with joke cards were required and pushed to be have some component of Vintage tournament legal cards in them so they could sell boosties. And that means we're stuck in this situation now where they looked at those sticker cards and said, oh yeah, we can allow those in tournaments. And then they realized how much of a problem that was.
So let me read the second paragraph here and then I'll hand over the third and fourth to you. And then I'll take us on with the fifth. Loris Dex, second paragraph, first sentence. Loris Dex featuring Urza Saga have had the top spot in the metagame over the past year or so, often with representatives taking multiple spots in top eights, both in tabletop events and Magic Online challenges. I'll just parenthetically note that in the May announcement, they did actually note that we are keeping our eyes on Loris and Urza Saga. So they actually indicated that they were paying attention to Urza Saga's prevalence and performance. So I assume that is true. That it has been, when we talked about our end of year reviews, I did actually think that I thought Saga, I actually expressed my preference for restricting Saga. So I won't hide the ball. I actually agree with this decision very, very wholeheartedly. Continuing the second,
and
go ahead.
Sorry, just to support your point, Steve, if you look at the MTG Goldfish stats for the last 30 or 90 or even 365 days, in each one of those configurations, Luris Saga has the greatest metagame share.
There you go. Second sentence, paragraph 2. While Luris Saga is widely regarded as a top strategy in Vintage, The opportunity cost of playing four copies of Urza Saga in the format is simply too low. I happen to also agree with that. In fact, that's the most surprising thing about Urza Saga to me, is that with Lorien, it's just you can play so many different colors off of you know, and get full support with the saga. So I think the opportunity cost is too slow. And then they also have incredible synergy with each other, because the creatures that they generate are complementary.
Absolutely.
Moving to sentence three, paragraph two, from Mishra's Workshop decks to Tinker decks, a number of strategies leverage this powerful land without narrowing their overall game plan. That's fundamentally the problem, in my opinion. And that actually takes this out of the category. So let's go back to our categories. It is not that there is a dominant deck, although you did say they have the best win percentage, right? So I don't know precisely what the win rate is for Saga decks, but that's part of the problem. It's hard to combine them into a single archetype or even strategy because they are so diverse strategically.
They're represented in the three major pillars of the format.
Right, all of them.
Those being combo control and
Prison,
basically.
Yeah. In terms of metagame diversity, so in terms of competitive balance, I don't think that's the problem. I don't think it's also, in terms of metagame diversity, narrowly defined. I think it is in terms of tactical diversity. That's the problem.
That's the thing I was alluding to earlier.
Yeah. So this restriction doesn't, I don't actually think it neatly fits my criteria. It's not a counterplay problem. It's not really a polarization problem.
I think, ironically, it is a counterplay problem, but we can talk more about that.
Okay. Why don't you make the case for why it's a counterplay problem?
Put simply, if the top two decks in the format, those being Lurrus Saga and Jewel Shops, if they are predictably both playing a four of, then it's just correct metagaming to play something that either tactically or strategically sidesteps that four of, that card, like addresses it in some way. And when you look at the next few decks across the format, there is simply no tactic that can be applied to Vintage that effectively mitigates the ubiquity of Urza's Saga.
Yes, that's true.
Like there's no gotcha deck that says, "Ha, your sagas are completely ineffectual against me." The only deck that can do that are ones that just ignore the saga, like say Doomsday or Dredge, right?
Which is an answer, just by render, the way. But go ahead.
From that lens, I believe that counterplay is one of the elements, a contributing factor to this, because there's just no one has identified anything throughout the whole Vintage card pool that effectively counteracts the sagas, except for your own sagas. And even in decks riddled with wastelands, which this format is a wasteland format, right? Even in that sense, where you've got you're playing a 4X saga deck and you're facing off against a 4X wasteland deck, the top two saga playing decks are also 4X wasteland decks.
Yes.
Like, so it's just laughable that there is not actually any counterplay from a tactical standpoint to saga.
Okay.
There is some strategic counterplay, but that is one of the scourges that the card represents.
I like I'm not persuaded of the overall point. I don't think that this was restricted because of counterplay, but the way you put you put it as a contributing factor, I'm willing to grant that.
Yes, then that is as far as I will say that.
is Saga decks, were they dominant? I don't know. It's possible. Did they enhance metagame diversity at the deck level? I don't think they actually diminished or enhanced metagame diversity, but I think they diminished tactical diversity. In terms of competitive balance, I don't think that was really a problem because there were other decks that didn't use it. But it's possible that they were just overall dominant. Like, I don't know the percentage of decks in the metagame that had them. Do you have your fingertip that is like 30%, 33%, whatever? I think we actually saw some data that was in the 30s. Well, go ahead. Of top eights.
So if you look at the MTG Goldfish stats for Vintage over the last 365 days, now that's one lens, that's not the only lens, but Lurrus is top metagame percentage at 16%. Jewel Shops is second at 12%.
Those are the top two. That's not dominant at all. Yeah.
No, in terms of individual archetypes, that is definitely not dominant, right? 16%, totally reasonable. But if you look then at the decks that comprise the top, say, I'm eyeballing about 80%, that's 10 decks, effectively. And of those 10, you've got 16% plus 12, that's 28. You've got another 6.5%. You're at 34. You've got another 5%. You're at 39. You've got another 4%. You're upwards of 40% of those of the metagame share are 4X Saga decks.
That's a dominant tactic. Exactly. I actually think that gets you into dominance. So I think that's the basis on which this had to happen. There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Now, they're mentioning Luris a lot, especially in the opening of this explanation.
Yes.
And I think that elides actually the primary application of the diversity argument.
Well, unpack what you just meant there. How does that elide that?
Well, I mean, point to a second deck being referenced in this explanation.
There are no. These are just tactics we're talking. Well, they did say Mishra's Workshop and Tinker decks, and they did mention Luris decks. So
yeah, and that's at the end of the second paragraph here, right? they do touch on it. It's just that the references to this whole explanation leads with Luris.
Yeah.
Since the removal of Luris the Dream Den, ..
Interesting.
That's not actually the primary driver. They've buried the lead here.
So let me finish.
The primary driver is from Mishra's Workshop decks to Tinker decks, including Luris, which you've been talking about. A number of strategies leverage this powerful land without narrowing their overall game plan.
Yeah, let me just read this, the end of the paragraph. Nearly all decks run a suite of artifacts that cost 0 or 1 mana, of course, except for Dredge, of course. From Mishra's Workshop to Tinker decks, a number of strategies leverage this powerful land without narrowing their overall game plan. So there you go. That is paragraph 2. Kevin, why don't you go to paragraph 3?
As a top 5 most played unrestricted card in Vintage, which is true according to the data we can see, the restriction of Urza's Saga is unlikely to remove it from many of the strategies it is currently played in, although that will happen to a degree. That's a bit of speculation there, of course, on their part. We can tease out what we think in a minute.
But before you move on, why don't they just say unlikely to remove it from the strategies it is currently played in, although it may decline in terms of frequency? Those are different ideas, right? Exclusion is not the same thing as decrease, right? Like, I can say we expect this restriction to result in a decrease in metagame share, not a disappearance. Like, you could have just said that. Like, look, this is a conceptual conceptual error in my opinion. What does it mean to remove it to a degree? Something is either included or it's excluded. Like, I understand what they're saying, but it's just imprecise language in my opinion. You could have just go ahead.
It feels like they're trying to enact a rhetorical feeling or maybe preemptively avoid concern on the player's base or something along those lines. When I'm with you, you can just say we expect this to have this effect.
Yeah, if I were to say to you, Kevin, you're somewhat included in my party. Like, what does that even mean? Like, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? It's conceptual.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's like you can't. I expect you to be. It just doesn't make sense.
Well,
yeah.
But let's go on though, because the next sentence. It reinforces what they're getting at. It says, fewer games will be decided by a pair of 6/6 construct tokens and a burst of Black Lotus mana on turns 3 to 4. So they set this up, they set that particular play pattern up as an example of what just innately happens across archetypes.
Yes.
And I think that actually supports the final sentence of the prior paragraph, right? From workshop decks to tinker decks, a number of strategies are leveraging this. This speaks to, again, this reinforces the homogeneity of the play patterns.
Yes.
Where irrespective of archetype, you can expect a significant portion of your Vintage games to just end by getting beat down by 2 6/6s that came out of a land, an uncounterable land, right? And because there's just no reliable tactics that allow you to stop that from happening, again, reliable tactics that allow you to stop that from happening, it's just a repeated play pattern across multiple different Vintage games, irrespective of archetypes.
Yes.
The third paragraph concludes with, this should lead to a more diverse range of experiences.
Yes.
That's a fun word. Let's talk about that word. For players to enjoy in Vintage. For the reason mentioned above, Urza's Saga is restricted in Vintage. So that concludes the Saga portion.
So it seems to me, reading it holistically, they put, I would say that the main emphasis is on the play patterns. The secondary emphasis is on the tactical homogeneity. In my opinion, I think it's fine to restrict on both bases, but I think just quantifiably, the bigger problem is just it's just a dominant tactic. Like being 40% of decks across archetypes, and it's one thing if it's just a small tactic, but it actually predominates play patterns, right? It's like this thing happens And this, and there's like nothing else that happens in that period. It's just this thing over and over again, this particular dynamic. So I think it's been overdue, and I applaud them for this decision. And I have to say, just to be clear about this, if you going to the fact that I had five criteria, right, which are metagame dominance, metagame diversity, competitive balance, counterplay, and polarization, and even if we just take it down to three, let's say we're just doing metagame diversity, competitive balance, and counterplay. And just assume that polarization is subsumed under competitive balance, and assume that dominance is subsumed under metagame diversity, right? Because a deck that's if you have a dominant deck, it's really hard to have metagame diversity. Even if you just have those three criteria, you're going to have tensions between them, right? So like, if you say there's a card in a deck that creates that is not necessarily dominant and is balanced, but creates a poor counterplay opportunities, and you restrict it, you actually thereby reduce metagame diversity necessarily, right? It's like you have a habitat, right? In the habitat, you introduce, I don't know, I was reading this weekend about lobstermen and fishing in Maine, and there's some weird like jelly creature that was introduced on tankers that are coming into the environment, and they're messing up the ecology. Like, you're actually increasing technically the diversity of the environment, but you're actually ruining the ecosystem. So it's not always diversity. It's not always let's max out on diversity if you're having knock-on effects that are undesirable, right? Like, there's a reason that, like, if you're leaving or entering the country, they don't want you to bring, like, fruit or animals because they don't want to contaminate the environment, right? So, right? I mean, it's like...
I'm loving these ecology analogies today. This is great.
well, so I think the way that I would characterize it is they are essentially saying that there is this dominant play pattern, and the play pattern is incorporated tactically in too large of a range of decks at too low of a cost because it doesn't interfere with the strategic objective. So you could be playing a million different kinds of decks and still have this play pattern unfold. I think that's a very legitimate point.
That summary, which I totally agree with, is what I was alluding to at the start when I mentioned that this particular, let's call it model for a restriction is very rare in the history of the format.
Yes, because it's not a strategic card. I mean, it is a strategic objective, but it's not generally the ultimate strategic objective. Like a lot of these decks have other plans, right? If they win with Saga, great. And if they use Saga to muck up their opponent's plans, great. But it's not like Mentor. It's not like Doomsday. It's not like the Tendrils kill, you know, like Yogg-Well and the Tendrils. It's not Breach into, what's the other Storm card, Kevin? Remind me
Brain Freeze?
Yeah, it's not Breach into Brain Freeze. It's not Yogg-Will into Tendrils. It's not... What's the other... What's the ad nauseum card that's used? Not ad nauseum, but the Grim Tutor card that we were...
I'm not following
the
you.
The 4-mana, the black card that finds Yogg-Will.
Oh, Beseech the
Queen.
Yeah,
sorry. It's not Beseech into Tendrils, right? It's not...
Right.
Those are intermediate objectives that you're really trying to get to. They get you to your final objective. But you don't build towards a Saga for the most part. You just use it tactically. So,
I would posit that we haven't had a restriction in this model in the modern era, and I'm using the term modern era to refer, to the 21st century. But back in the early days, there was the restriction of Maze of Ith, right?
Yes,
which might have been in this model, but it was in the early days, right? And maybe you could point to Strip Mine as a restriction that meets this
wasteland
model, but that was also one of redundancy because of Wasteland.
Yeah.
It's possible that we've never truly had a restriction that was about exactly this.
Well, you know, there is a... That's interesting. I'm just looking through to see...
Yeah, I was scouring the history also. Because so many restrictions
are
due
to... a particular deck strategy.
Yeah. And if it was being used in more than one deck, it was still the primary strategy.
You know
what
it is? It's like Merchant Scroll. That's what it's like.
Mm, That's an interesting one. Although
it's not quite that. I mean, Merchant Scroll
pretty narrowly targeted, wasn't it?
But Merchant Scroll is actually not as bad as Saga, because it's
far from it.
Yeah, I mean, Merchant Scroll was used in the Gush decks. It was used in the Flash decks. It was used in the Oath decks. It was used across strategies. But
Gifts is the thing that got Scroll the axe.
No, because remember, Scroll was restricted when. Gifts was actually restricted way before Scroll. Scroll was restricted. Let me get this. Scroll was restricted in 2008.
Wasn't in the Gifts pile. I mean,
no, it was
the Gifts group.
But Gifts was restricted in 2007. So Gifts was restricted a year before Scroll.
Gifts was restricted when Gush was restricted in 2008.
Gifts was restricted when Gush was unrestricted.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. What I meant to say was that Scroll was restricted when Gush went.
Yes.
And it should have happened sooner.
Yes.
It should have happened as part
of
the Gifts group.
Agree.
That's what I was conflating.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think
anyway, my point is that was still pretty narrowly targeted, though. It's not like Scroll wasn't restricted because three or four different decks comprising 50% of the metagame was using it, right?
Well, it's
close.
You could get,
it's close.
Maybe a closer case would be Mentor. Mentor was used Mentor was used in the Paradoxical Outcome decks. It was used in the Gush Xerox decks. It was used in combo decks is like a finisher. You know, it was just broadly used, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that's a fair comparison too.
But I think
there hasn't been anything as ubiquitous
as Saga has been
across archetypes.
In terms of its extent or degree of use, I think you might be right. I think there is not. Yeah. I mean, you probably have to look at something like Wasteland Stripmine. You really do. And Stripmine is a very interesting case, because Stripmine was not restricted until Wasteland was printed.
Yeah, and which was arguably overdue.
Yeah, and then Wasteland was also restricted. They're like, screw this. Sorry.
Then Stripmine was also restricted.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Go ahead.
We haven't finished the whole readout here, so we could move on to Vexing Bauble, or we could continue talking about Saga. Because Bauble, while it has some things in common, is a different creature.
Totally different, yeah. Let's pivot. Kevin, why don't you read the fourth paragraph, and then I'll take us on with the last. Go ahead.
All right. So now we're switching gears and we're talking about Bauble. They begin. While we're talking about some of the most played unrestricted cards in Vintage, let's talk Vexing Bauble. Again, talking about play quantity here. This little gem from Modern Horizons 3 was created to stop folks from using various free spells in Modern, like Grief, Force of Negation, Living End, and other things that you'd like to not happen. This is a reasonable goal in some formats, but not necessarily in others. So that's just mostly preamble about the design goals of the Bauble.
Yes. I want to say something about Modern Horizons 3. So if you look at the history of restriction, in almost every single case, since the middle 90s, the card has been in the format for 6 months before restriction.
Mm-hmm.
The exception that we have seen, let's see if I can... So Narset, for example, was in the format... God, how long was it? Came out in May, was restricted in November. Think about Dig Through Time and Treasure Cruise. Kevin, those were released in October... And they were restricted. What was it like in March? I think it was December and then March.
Yeah.
Like Dig was in the format for like, I think it was longer than that. I think Dig was in the format for like a year actually. Like,
and that was a situation where that was a Three Stooges situation where nobody could fit through the door at the same time, right? You just couldn't build a deck that had eight of those. And so you played with the more broken one to start with.
Yeah.
I remember that
actually,
vividly.
Here it is. Dig is restricted in September 28th, 2015. So it was legal actually for 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
Treasure Cruise was restricted in January, which is one of the swiftest restrictions we've ever seen. And that was 34% of top eights. That was a straight up dominance thing. Like almost as dominant as Thirst was at its heyday. Typically speaking, so if they really believe, going back to their first paragraph, that the format evolved slowly, I think this was too soon. This is August 26th. This card came out. If you look at our timeline, Hold on. Let me give you the exact release date. Hold on. It was released officially June 14th is the official release date. June 14th, July 14th, August 14th, August. That's basically 2 months and 13 days, Kevin.
Yep.
That is one of the fastest restrictions in the history of the format, and I'm not kidding you. Like, that is very, very, very fast, and I think that's way too fast, honestly. I just do. I understand that there might be a different case if there's a cards that don't have counterplay, but can you think of a card that was restricted that fast? I mean, how fast were...
Mind's Desire?
Yes, Mind's Desire is the biggest case because it was the only card in the history of the form that was preemptively restricted. Now, people will say point to Memory Jar in Standard as being but Memory Jar was actually legal in Vintage, wasn't it? I think it was. Let me see.
Oh, yeah, it was banned very quickly in Standard, but you're right, it was legal in Vintage for longer.
So it was.
I don't know how long.
Memory Jar. Okay, I can give you exactly. Urza's Legacy became legal March 1st of 1999. And Memory Jar and Time Spiral were restricted on April 1st to take effect.
Okay.
Remember, they took effect a month. Wait. I think it took effect on April 1st because at the time there was a month to take effect. So I think it actually, I think that Urza's Saga was released on the February 28th or March 1st and it was announced to be restricted. I can't actually, hold on. Oh yeah, that's right. Because Spiral was in Saga. So Spiral had been legal for 3 months. Spiral was released on November 1st and was announced restricted March 1st, effective April 1st. Jar was only legal in the format for 1 month. So that, until Mind's Desire, Memory Jar had the least amount of time in the Vintage format, in the Type 1 format of any card ever, basically.
Yeah.
1 month. It's not until you get to Desire that's actually preemptively restricted. So,
fascinating.
So just to be clear, for Desire, yeah. So it's very close. Okay, remember they took times for cards to actually be legal in a format, but it says here, according to Wikipedia, Scourge was released on May 26th, 2003. And the banned and restricted list announcement was immediate. Let me look at the actual date of it. It was June 1st. So it wasn't actually, there was never a date that it was actually legal. Because there was only, you know, 3 days, if you want to be technical about it, right? So Kevin, it was preemptive. But the point is, in the last 20 years, what even comes close to that in terms of a period of play? I mean, because I just want to make sure I'm really clear on the dates for Modern Horizons 1 restrictions. So Modern Horizons 1 is officially released on June 13th, 2019. And the restrictions were not until about this time. It says August 22nd is when Commander came out, and August 26th is when Mystic Forge, Karn, Golgari Grave Troll, and Misstep were restricted. And only two of those cards, by the way, were from Modern Horizons 1, Mystic Forge and Karn. And so they were actually, it's the exact same parallel period, June 13th to August 26th.
An announcement policy is a factor here as well, right? When we're getting down to this minutia of within a month or something, the fact that they've changed their policy a few times about how often they make these announcements, and so that influences these stats. And also, so does the effectiveness window, which you mentioned a minute ago. We used to have to just wait a month and still get to play with the cards. And the other thing, too, is that a couple of those announcements were quote-unquote emergencies, right? A couple of them were off-cycle announcements. And so... your point, though, is still well made. This is, in the history of the format, this is a very aggressive announcement from release to restriction.
Yes. I don't like it. I think if you're going to restrict a card for counterplay reasons, I think it needed a little bit more time. I mean, not even Flash was restricted this fast, Kevin. I'm serious.
Let's talk about Trinisphere, because Trinisphere
was in the format for an entire year. Flash was in the format as an errated card for about 6 months. I could look it up, but you get the point. Okay, let's go to the last paragraph. I'll read it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, specifically, you play Vintage to play the most powerful spells in the history of Magic! Exclamation point. I don't think that's untrue. A player who goes first and can resolve a vexing bauble before their opponent takes a turn, effectively shuts them out of playing all their cool cards after you've had a chance to play your own. Moxen, Lotuses, and Force of Wills are a major reason folks are drawn to the format. Playing, or let me pause there, because that's three sentences. Any comments on that, Kevin?
Well, just that this is... there are some tautologies here,
yes.
Right? Like, you play Vintage to play the most powerful spells in the history of Magic. Yeah, that's true. But that's not a statement of policy, right? And ditto the last statements. Mox and Lotus and Force were on major reasons drawn to the format. That's a repetition of the same concept, just said a different way. But there's a gameplay observation sandwiched in here, which is a player goes first and can resolve a bauble before their opponent takes a turn, effectively shuts out playing all the cool cards, right? That is also a tautology, right? That's just a statement of, if you go first and play this card, it renders a lot of commonly played, very popular, and beloved cards in the format uncastable. And that same observation was true of Chalice.
Yes.
Right?
That's what they're drawing a connection to before they even say it. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me continue on then. Playing with 2 to 4 of these isn't even that big of a hindrance to your own strategy. Unlike something like a Chalice of the Void, as you can sacrifice extra copies, resolve more 0-mana spells, and then resolve another before passing the turn. I have to take some objection like this, because I have to say, like, Chalice of the Void could be played at non-zero, and frequently was. So, I don't, like, hello, that's what workshop decks did. Okay, I'll Chalice you for 0, now I'll Chalice you for 1, now I'll Chalice you for 2. Like, that's, I mean, it sort of implies that it was a hindrance. I don't think it necessarily was, but...
And that's fair. I mean, we've all been there, though, where you play Chalice on 0, even on the play, and then you top deck a Mox or 2, you know, over the course of the next few turns. That it's a non-zero. It's a tautology to say that Vexing Bauble has a built-in parachute, which Chalice never did, so to speak. Or you had to play additional cards to give Chalice that parachute, like, say, Arcbound Ravager.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, I specifically said in our set review that I think that the ability to sacrifice itself is really important to its playability. So that was part of our prediction, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But really, Steve, I think that the arguments for Vexing Bauble overlap so much with Saga that when they wrote this article, they sort of elided the fact that a lot of the same things can be said about the two. I do sort of wish they had at least alluded to some of the same factors. It would have been unsatisfying language, probably, but it would have at least addressed the fact that ubiquity is also part of the equation for Bauble, right? It's not just about, hey, Vintage players want to cast their Moxen. Like, and put simply, it can't be about that, right? That's some kind of appeal to the mob mentality that I just don't really want to be a dominant force in our policy, and it is simply the only thing referenced here,
so,
which makes it feel like it was the only thing considered, which I really, really super hope is not true.
Well, do you even know if people were complaining about this that much? I mean, okay, let's finish.
No, I don't
let's
know.
Let's finish reading about reading this, and then let's look at the data. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see.
You were just at the last sentence.
Okay. In the spirit of keeping Vintage about Vintage, boy, there's a beauty. Vintage
right.
Bauble is restricted. Oh no, I didn't finish the sentence, did I? Yeah, I did. I said you can resolve 0-mana spells and resolve another with passing the turn. Okay. So if people were actually like up in arms about this, I sure as heck didn't see it. It's not like the mana drain exists anymore, so we can see the big threads. But I didn't see a lot of that many complaints about this to drive this to restriction. I mean, look, my issue is not that this was restricted. It's the timing of the restriction. I feel like they just didn't give this very much time. 2 months and 2 weeks is not even close to enough.
And you can observe that effect in action if you look at the quantities of baubles played per deck list over the course of the last 2 months. And now, I don't have an encyclopedic data set to point you to here, but my observation, because we've recently recorded reviewing this card, right, and we had some preliminary results then, my observation is simply that when this card came out, it was like a 3 or 4 of in a lot of decks. And now it is demonstrably fewer than that. It's down to a one or a two of, right? It's down to, in many cases, a saga target, a one of, and maybe an extras in the sideboard. And so the fate of this card is inexorably tied to Urza's Saga. And I'm a little surprised that they don't acknowledge this in any way, the fact that these two cards are go hand in hand, because it seems fairly predictable that you can't, when Saga's restricted, you can no longer just put a one of Vexing Bauble in your deck and go get it when you want it, right? You can't do that, or at least it's significantly less reliable to do so. So the net effect that this is going to have is this is going to push the people who are on the fence and their Bauble counts on a one or a two of, it's going to push them one way or the other. It's going to push them off the fence such that you can no longer play this card, or you're going to be rewarded for playing three or four of them, right? And given the structure of the metagame, I anticipate that the four ofs are not going to be the dominant result. I predict this is going to mostly push this card out of the metagame or push it to a sideboard only card where the quantity will have to be three or four, I would argue. But that's just my own personal anticipation. And I'm a little surprised that they, given how much explanation there was about Saga, unsatisfying though it might be in some cases, that they've pretty much only appealed to community sentiment when it comes to the Bauble and the play draw effect.
Wow.
I firmly expect that Vexing Bauble is going to become a zero or four of now and almost never played in the main anymore, unless there is a four of Bauble, you know, main deck Bauble deck like Prison Shops. I shouldn't say if there is. There is such a deck, but if it becomes more of a significant part of the metagame than it is, which is down in the single digits right now.
Well, it's going to be a permanent card main deck in every workshop deck forever. So,
You need to caveat that. It's not going to be necessarily in jewel shops.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're talking about workshop prison.
Yeah, sorry. Right? And aggro, yes.
Which is like any deck which is like a 3 or 4% deck
right
now.
Any deck that would have a Chalice of the Void main deck that has mana will probably play this.
Yes, I totally agree. So, or, I don't know, there's an outside chance that maybe certain outcome builds would still run this it has extra synergy
and
there.
And if you have a Loras deck, you would certainly use this. So,
well, I don't necessarily agree with you there. How many different 0 and 1 mana metagame hosers are competing for that deck slot in a Loras deck, right?
We talked about that, but that was one of the things that we wanted to know what the result would be. What is the marginal value of one, you know, of the effect over the mana cost?
Right. There's a half dozen cards competing for that reusable meta hoser spot that you're alluding to there, and I'm not convinced that the Bauble gets the nod going forward.
And with,
but that's entirely derivative.
Also, to my point earlier about the interactive nature of restrictions, like restricting Saga is going to impact this card.
Right.
It just is.
Your point is doubly true. Like if you're planning to axe Saga, then you really ought to just axe Saga because it clearly has system effects on this card, Bauble, among many other cards. Like look at the trickle down effects on Lorien revealed.
Yes.
Now I'm not saying Lorien's going to go away. I'm just saying these influence one another.
Yes.
There are major systemic interactions here from a deck construction standpoint.
They should have given that time to play out. What they should have done here is they should have said we are watching Vexing Bauble like they did in May. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I predict that with a restricted Saga, they would not have had to take action on Bauble.
Too damn bad. Oh, well. So,
yeah.
I agree with Saga. I disagree with Bauble. What is your verdict, Kevin?
I am torn on...
Before you give your verdict, do you have any data on Bauble that you wanted to present?
I have some interesting data, so we can talk about that in a minute. But to answer your question, I don't agree on Bauble, same as you. I think it was premature, especially if you were given that you were going to restrict Saga. And Saga, I'm a little torn on. I want to ask you a philosophical question, but I want to talk about the data a little bit first, just to put things in context. So let me talk about the data effects. When it comes to ubiquity, there are some things that you can use that are fairly easy to measure. And I'm getting this from Goldfish. There's other things you can look at, too, in terms of just metagame presence for popular decks, which I alluded to a minute ago. Goldfish does this nice thing where it looks at most cards played across the format, and it breaks them down by some categories like land and creature and spells, which basically is just everything else. When you look at land, they track a couple of metrics. They track percentage of decks, meaning what percentage of the metagame plays the card, and they also track it's average, although I'm not 100% sure it's average, number or quantity, you know, copies played per deck, right? And so that tells you for cards like Strip Mine, how many copies do people play? Well, they play one. For cards like, you know, Ancient Tomb, how many copies do they play? Well, they play four, right? Same with Mishra's Workshop. But for other types of lands, like, say, I don't know, Volcanic Island, how many copies do you play? Well, it turns out it's 2.7. So if you look at those two numbers, Urza Saga scores very highly on that list. But there's some other system effects too. And that is, you can get a kind of hybrid metric of the two if you multiply those two numbers, which is the number of decks playing it times the copies that they're playing, which gives you a new hybrid measure of how often are you seeing this card in the average vintage game, right? And if you make that hybrid metric, which it doesn't have any units, so I'm just going to not even talk about what the value is. So if you order the lands in the format by that metric, the top three lands are Strip Mine, which is restricted,
yes,
and Wasteland and Urza Saga. Wow. And it's not even close.
What are they? You said Strip Mine, Wasteland, and Urza Saga? Okay.
Right. And if you consider the fact that Strip Mine is restricted, right, therefore appearing in dramatically fewer games, what that tells you is that the most common lands you're going to see in Vintage, irrespective of archetype, are Wasteland and Urza Saga. And they're neck and neck, right? And then there's a fall off to Underground Sea, which is a fairly predictable result. But there's a fair gap there. So what this tells you is about the homogeneity of tactics, right? That your average vintage game is just, and it is above average, it's above 50%, but your average vintage game is just gonna feature either a Wasteland or a Saga or both, right? And you get, it's, and everything else is below the fold. Everything else is below the 50% mark and quickly below that, right? Underground Seas, yeah, and then Ancient Tombs drop off to like 30%, right? The same is true, ironically, with Vexing Bauble. So if you do the same math, number of the percentage of decks playing the card, copies played, and then you normalize for restricted cards, right? Because, Steve, if you had to guess, what do you think is the most played non-land card in Vintage?
Force of Will.
No. This is the most famous card in the format.
Oh, you said the most non-land played card in Vintage?
The most played non-land card in terms of percentage of decks.
Well, you say, okay, it's Black Lotus. Sorry.
Yeah,
so
you are
correct.
I thought
Black you meant
Lotus.
Most... copies.
Well, in that lens, your answer is also correct,
yeah.
Because if you normalize for restricted cards, which,
yes,
you know, 9 of the top 10 are restricted cards, and if you just look at cards that can be played of four ofs, you are completely correct. Force of Will is number one, 80% of decks, and when they play Force of Will, they play all four copies, right? The next card on that list, if you use the hybrid metric I'm talking about, that is decks that play it times quantity played, is one I would never have guessed. Never have guessed. Second place on that list, again, we're normalizing out restricted cards, is Force of Negation.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Third on that list is Vexing Bauble.
Wow. Wow.
Think about that.
That's wild.
Force of Will, Force of Negation, and then Vexing Bauble.
Well,
now, this is taken over a longer period of time, and so that number may be diminishing as we speak due to metagame effects. So it may be a little overstated, but the fact of the matter is, if you look at that metric, the card is just omnipresent.
Wow.
It's all over the place. It's going to be a factor in, more often than not, your vintage game. It's also worth noting that is... Everything else is below the fold, as I said, below 50%. Vexing Bauble, Force of Negation, and Force of Will are the three cards that are unrestricted that appear above the fold. Wait, strike that. There's two other sideboard cards I should mention. Grafdigger's Cage and Pithing Needle are also both above 50%. But that's where we're talking about the Urza Saga effects too, right? Needle's play is bolstered by Saga. Just as Bauble's will, Needle's play will dip some amount. We can't say exactly how much. So the fact is, when you look at the stats from a homogeneity perspective and it's a uniformity of tactics, again, across archetypes, Vexing Bauble it's up there with Force of Will.
Yeah. Wow. I had no idea. I mean, well, I had no idea because we didn't even get a chance to do our report card yet.
Right.
Right? It's not even the 3-month mark. So,
right.
Like, what the hell? No. I mean, I guess they have the data and you have the data and there's a case to be made. I just wish I had.
Well,
yeah.
it, even if the data supports some of those things, as we're acknowledging, the primary objection I have to it is the one that you have initially stated, which is the system effects tell you that you should not, and we've seen this over and over again throughout history, you should not change systematically connected cards at the same time. You just shouldn't. And yes, you alluded to that earlier when you talked about how group restrictions inevitably lead to makeup unrestrictions later on. Now, there are multiple reasons for that, but we don't need to rehash that. So you asked me, am I in favor of these? No on Vexing Bauble and a tentative yes on Saga.
Interesting.
I think, okay. I think it was... But they shouldn't have been done at the same time, yes, right? So with that caveat.
But I think their I would
have been okay with
an
Urza Saga restriction for a while now.
I think someone posted on Twitter that the next announcement was not going to be till December or something. So that's why they won't.
Right. And there's an element, too, I want to point to about pillars of the format. This is the philosophy question I wanted to get into with you. And that is, we've had pillars in this format for ages. And, you know, at the top, they represent basically workshops and null rods and bazaars and force of will, arguably. And then it gets a little wishy-washy after that, right? Is Oath of Druids a pillar of the format? If it got up to 40% of top eights, we'd be talking about restriction, right? Is Paradoxical Outcome now a pillar of the format? It's debatable, right? So there are some fringe notes, but frequently they develop around lands. Well, now in the modern age, especially with the advent of cards like Saga and Lorien revealed, it has become so easy to just hybridize these mana sources and still make your mana work. You and I know, we were pioneers of colorful workshop decks back in the day, right? we tried all manner of different configurations to make workshops and islands play nicely together. Well, in the modern era of Lorien revealed, Urza's Saga, as well as MDFCs, right? Sink into stupor now. That has become so much easier. And never mind the fact that the primary card people are casting off Mishra's Workshop is a card that taps for 3 blue, right?
Wild,
that helps,
yeah,
things as a matter of course as well. So this notion of having to make sacrifices, it really kind of only applies to Bazaar anymore, because Workshop is fully integrated into the Force of Will decks now, fully. And so this notion of pillars is getting blurrier and blurrier as time goes by. And as time goes by, the newer printings are the ones that are just more likely to get the axe, of course. And I think that was the thing that, in my eyes, made the Urza Saga restriction the most defensible here, is using the applications irrespective of archetype is just a bridge too far in my eyes.
Okay. Well, I think we should go to our wrap, Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
We've been... This, I think, thoroughly analyzed this. It's a very interesting set of restrictions. The timing is strange on both of them, I think. There is a case to be made, I have to say, for hitting these before the Vintage Championships. So I have to give them the credit for that. You don't want a championship marred by poor experience, you know. But I think I still would have, just for the integrity of the format and the integrity of policy choice, preferred they just hit Saga. So...
That's true, and I agree with you, and for everything you just said. There also, I think there's an acknowledgement on this article that they're going to continue to re-examine their approach to the pace of announcements, and people have noticed that when they shifted their recent pace to be shortly after set release and then were unwilling to ban cards from the most recent set, for probably economic reasons, we must be honest, that demonstrated a flaw in their policy, and I think they've started to address that head on. We don't need to get into that any further here and now, but because that doesn't affect Vintage nearly so much. But in this case, as you said, they really ripped the Band-Aid off when it came to Vexing Bauble, possibly overly aggressively so.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kevin. It was...
Yep. Thank you, Steve. I always appreciate the historical reference that we get with these shows. And in case our audience hasn't observed, we are improving our documentation of the history of the format at every possible juncture these days, right? We're creating new and better reference documents so we can cite things like,
time,
you know, the minimum and maximum size of the restricted list over time and that kind of thing. And we're trying to bring more real concrete stats. Yeah, to the discussion, to put these things into perspective. And we'll continue to do so. So with that, thank you for listening to episode 11D4 of So Many Insane Plays. You can tweet us at Many Insane Plays or email us at somanyinsaneplayspodcast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a rating on iTunes so other players can find us. As always, and until next time, we wish you many insane plays. Deep blue.
Game.